Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 104, where Rowan, Tom, Pedro, and our special guest Shelby Guy are discussing a book chapter by Arthur L. Stinchcomb titled Social Structure in Organizations, published in the Handbook of Organizations in 1965 by Rand McNally and edited by James March. In part two, we extend Stinchcomb's arguments to look at how organizations impact societies, especially in the contemporary context. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So in part one, we already talked a little bit about the role of technology, on how the organization and society interrelate with each other, in the extent in which the symbolic discourses and cultural ideas influence the way new forms emerge, right? But I think that what was missing a little bit in the text is more about how the organization can influence the society. So in this two-way street, I was missing one of part of the story. And I think that it's particularly important to talk about that in light of the growing, you know, disproportionate impact that some organizations can have, which are, you know, have more capital and power, or at least access to influence than entire countries, right? I'm just thinking about some Silicon Valley firms, but I can think of others as well. I think it's particularly important to look at the impact of organization in the environment. And one place to start looking at that is in how they may help constructing and putting forward particular ideologies, particular understandings, particular meanings, values, because as Stinchcomb says, that's one important element on how organizations endure, a particular form endures, but this can also be manufactured by organizations to then legitimize, normalize a particular way of operating, a particular type of employment contract, a particular distribution of resources, right? So this is not just happening in society independent from organizations, but they can be the product of almost purposeful work of some type of organizations. Of course, one example that comes to mind in Uber and the whole debate that existed when it emerged on whether the people that work for Uber are employees or not, and how we try to frame as not employees to evade regulation, and how in some places in the world, many courts, the legal system resisted that. And, you know, so there is, I think, also this important new dimension in this story that has become particularly salient in our current times.
Yeah, and I mean, along the lines, in fact, when you said, talked about Uber and contract workers, that got me thinking as well. I wonder to what extent this could fit with Stinchcomb's story, where changing technologies such as communication technologies, the ability to have these apps and these kinds of platforms, changing economic conditions where you're able to do these kinds of contract labors, have led to these kinds of organizations, which are in turn, to bring your point up now, Pedro, which are in turn changing how society is structured, where now, you know, Jerry Davis famously talks about how before we had, before we had careers, then we had jobs, and now we just have tasks. So these kinds of organizations then lead to people, you know, your probably neighbors down the street who are living these task-based lives. And that could be a way this circles around back to the organization structure affecting social structure.
Yeah, I think... This is a good example of, you know, maybe in Stinchcomb's time, it was all about, okay, how does society impact organizations, you know, sort of heavy on the one way. But here, when we start thinking about technology and the organization, how it impacts societies, we can now really see a lot more of that co-evolution coming about, because the social behavior of looking for an Uber, you know, going to an app, as opposed to trying to go to a public corner and hailing a taxi cab. Think about how, I don't want to name specific companies, but those that do food delivery to the house, the proliferation of them, that changes the way in which we think about food, not just cook or go out. Now we have this weird hybrid where we do takeout coming to the house, which changes the way that we plan meals, which changes so many, you know, and goes back onto the technology. A lot of co-evolution is embedded in the way that the technologies, the organizations that crop up to leverage those technologies, provide services, and society as the customer, consumer, et cetera, all of that working together.
Yeah, it really did seem like Sinchcombe had a perspective of, okay, when we're talking about the organization and environment, right, the emphasis is on the environment affecting things within the organization, right? And now as we're thinking about the opposite of that, of the organization's effect on the environment, it's sort of providing a little bit more agency there, right? So from a strategic perspective, we're saying, yeah, organizations have constraints that are put upon them, but they also have some agency and some discretion to be able to reshape that. And so one of the things that was very apparent in the first reading of Sinchcombe was that, okay, I can see where resource dependence is coming in, right? I can see RBV in this. I can see institutional theory, right? I can see sort of categories coming about. And sort of applying that to now our current context and say, okay, well, I can see where social movements can play a role. I can see how political elements, right, that were not as evident within his essay are sort of like coming into the foreground now. And this idea that it's organizations can reshape society, not just through their products, not just through their hiring, not just through their expansion and their strategic initiatives, right? But through all of the above and more, right? Through whatever they do is going to have some kind of impact. And that co-evolution that Tom was talking about is just such a, it allows for that kind of call and response, the cause and effect kind of element that makes studying organizations so difficult. Because of its complexity, but so again, so rewarding because of the excitement there.
And I do think this co-evolution, if you think of this kind of as a double loop of society and organizations, I don't want to, I guess, make a strong claim of what Sinchcombe doesn't, but to a large extent, it's technology that drives, even though technology is itself a product of this co-evolution, and I think a reasonable degree of technological determinism there where it drives the phase shifts in these loops. So the loops continue, but every time there's a significant technological change, it changes the whole paradigm. In today's world, we have, of course, you had OpenAI doing their R&D on large language models, and then there might have been internal politics and things that shaped the technology, but once they put it out there in this kind of Sinchcombian diagram, it probably leads to a whole new circle of now both society and organizations affecting each other given this new, entirely new technology.
So very, like, just quick response to that, right? I think that it really highlights an underlying point within Sinchcombe, where we've been talking about the environment and sort of this broad terms of, in terms of society, for example, versus the organization. But the environment is also comprised of organizations, right? So to the extent that one organization has come out with this crazy technology, right, that's going to affect the kind of responses from the other organizations as well. The example that came to mind was like Tesla, right? Really changed the sort of EV industry, really changed just the automobile industry writ large. But at the same time, now you have Ford coming out with electric vehicles. And because they're able to sort of adapt their existing routines and expertise, they can sort of compete in that car market against Tesla in ways that they couldn't before, and in ways that Tesla potentially, arguably, right, can't compete as a tech company and not a car company, right? So going from sort of the dichotomy of environment organizations to being like, okay, let's think about organizations versus other organizations. Let's think of environment in a much more abstract way can sort of open up lots of avenues for further investigation.
So I'm trying to think of what we have been saying and think of what we said in part one. And I think that one of the take-home lessons is that organizations have ways to frame or lobby or market them outside the liability of newness, either because they can stack the deck in their favor in the way the rules are created, or because they can shape citizens, clients, employees' perceptions through marketing. And also, we can even that if you were to apply that back in the 50s and 60s, the Cold War was also being done at the cultural level, right? So particular ways of consuming. I'm just thinking about fast food, right? And now it has taken over the world and so on. So that it's also, it's not just about the technical ways in which organization is set up and how is the hierarchy and what is the structure, but also what is familiar to us, what is acceptable. That fight, that strategy, that agency is being played out also at that level.
Yeah, I like that that point, Pedro, because you know, we've been using technology or technological advancements as sort of like our example so far, but we can also look at public infrastructure. For example, the highway system. You know, we were talking before about the 1950s and how it was a time of change. In the 1950s is when the interstate system was constructed in the United States, and what a significant change it imparted upon society at the time, because prior to that we were passenger railroad, the airplane, commercial air flights hadn't really started yet. All of a sudden we've got all of this infrastructure in place that makes people more mobile, and within a few short years we have towns dotted up along the highways, and other towns that were not along on the interstate were bypassed and dried up and died. So there's some significant changes that, you know, things like public infrastructure and the investments and the organizations put behind it imparted major changes in society in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. And I'm sure there are analogs in plenty of other places in the world.
I don't think you should scratch it, Tom, because one of the things that popped into my mind was that, yes, we have these technological advances. We have these sort of major changes that are happening. And yet certain things that Sinchcombe talked about, especially about what factors can contribute to the emergence of new organizations, still plays out, right? And one of the things that I really loved about one of the conditions was this idea that you have to have certain social groups that benefit from it, right? So new forms don't come out just because they're efficient. New forms have to come out because someone says that they can. They allow for it to happen. They provide the resources, whether it's wealth, power, legitimacy. And so when you're talking about the interstate system, I thought to myself, okay, well, now we're having this push because of emissions from cars, right, to have EVs, number one, right, like as a substitute, but also this push to like have go back to sort of railway systems, right, or like more electronics or subway systems. One of the issues that we have in Hawaii right now is that I'm from Hawaii, this is why I'm bringing it up, is that we have tons of cars, way too much traffic, probably the worst in the nation. And as a result, they've been trying to put in this rail system that's supposed to be very technologically advanced, right, that's supposed to be really socially benefit. But it hasn't, it's been over 10 years, almost close to 20 years, and it still really isn't in existence right now, because the elites that Sinchcombe mentions, they're not sort of throwing the weight of their approval behind it, right? And so it's this idea again that we're seeing these technological advances. Sinchcombe has emphasized the technical sort of functional elements there that can allow, set some of the conditions to allow for these organizations to emerge. And yet, the irrational, the political, right, the vested interests, the elites, right, the kind of power disparities, et cetera, right, they still exist. They're in a different form compared to the 1960s, but the dynamics, the constraints that they put on organizations and society in terms of their advancements is still there. And so what is old is still new, right?
Yeah, totally agreed. And I think also to bring back one aspect we discussed in part one here as well, where you talked about, Shelby, about how it's not necessarily trying to explain stability or change. It can be a both and. The one other feature of modern life that I wonder how Sinchcombe would speak to is when changes are themselves temporary or kind of time delimited. For example, Sinchcombe talks a little bit about wartime and how during wartime you have more initiative and a greater ability to quickly redeploy resources. And in today's world, we can abstract out from that to just moments of crisis. So in the case of COVID, when you're forming a kind of a vaccine collaborative just for those few years, it's interesting to think about how that affects, or rather how that works in conversation with the Sinchcombe piece, because in the Sinchcombe piece, there's a sense of percolation where over time we've got a dominant design or a dominant kind of working structure, which then gets imprinted and so on and so forth. And then we have generations versus more temporary organizing might involve, for example, actively drawing on social structures and resources and picking and choosing what works or doesn't work rather than letting a more kind of institutional trajectory take hold organically.
I think that's a really, really good example too, because here in several episodes, we've been talking about sort of like the backlash against the changes that COVID wrought and trying to, you know, the discussions about returning to work policies and things like that, how, well, a lot of organizations are trying to find that sweet spot between, do we go all the way back to the status quo ante, go back to the way that things were completely, versus others that say that, well, this remote distributed type of operation is the new normal. And so there's a lot of discussion about that. And what did we take away from COVID that's going to inform how we change emergency response to pandemic or other major emergencies going forward? Because the COVID response was very challenging. It exposed some vulnerabilities. And it also shapes in some ways how society reacts to the crisis management infrastructure. You know, do we trust governments to be able to take care of ourselves or something like that? A lot of questions, I think, are yet to be answered.
Just very quickly, Tom, one of the things that popped into my mind when you were talking about COVID revealing some of our dependencies and revealing some of our assumptions, potentially false assumptions, right? The first thing was this idea of essential workers, right? Who are the essential workers within the U.S., speaking from the U.S. context, that we just needed them for society to function? And look, I'm not a business school. Our whole focus is on training leaders and you know, future executives, right? The quote-unquote elites at the top of organizations. But when all of these things came to a standstill, who are the people that we relied on to make our society function? The essential workers, right? They're the quote unquote subordinates that Stinchcomb talks about. One of his points that he emphasizes in the essay is this idea that, you know, superiors are and the elites are tied to organizations, but a lot of what determines an organization's success is sort of the degree of dependence or independence of the subordinates, of the workers who actually work there, who make the firm function. And when we're talking about essential workers, when we're talking about the people who are being called back now to from remote work back into offices, et cetera, a lot of them are quitting in response to this. They've discovered their independence. They've discovered how much power they hold and how society sort of relies on them, and they're able to make different choices compared to what they were before. So again, the environment has changed, organization has responded, and now that things have quote unquote settled down a bit more, are we going to be returning to the old ways of working? Are we going to be able to exert the same kind of power dynamics that we were before? And I think the answer to both of them is not really, probably not.
I think this also introduces an aspect of what all of this looks like from the perspective of workers. And one, as you're hinting at, Shelby, is that maybe a crisis can be a shock in which new ways of working become normal, new attitudes towards the roles emerge, right? And then people may see them in a particular way. I don't know if there is any correlation, but I feel that there is more and more unionizing in the US context, since you were talking about the US context, right? So I think it's something that came to mind. But on a broader scale, I think it was also interesting that he insists a lot on this idea of the independence of, you know, basically he's talking about employees and managers, he's talking about subordinates and superordinates, but, you know, the subordinates, so to speak. And his house is such a current discussion about less hierarchical firms, you know, all of this reemergence of this debate. And maybe it's not not totally surprising, because the 60s already had a lot of attempts to more democratic firms and this kind of stuff, right? And there's also this vibrant or emerging debate, what it means to organize, especially, but not only in so-called knowledge work type of situations in which people are given more autonomy, the way tasks are distributed is more flexible, right? So I think there was also an interesting contemporary resonance about this debate, either if you want to look in terms of employment relations or just in the very way in which the organizational structure is set up internally in organizations.
And the other factor is that, and this is also what we've been discussing over the last few minutes, which is what the idea of an organization evoked in Stinchcomb's time was drastically different. And so then the employment relations questions becomes trickier, because Stinchcomb talks about, and this is on page 251 of the reprint version, about how an organization is a community of fate that is shared among unequals. And he says, I quote, "Organizational activity is in fact the main place where social classes meet on a continuous basis." Now, I don't know to what extent in current, let's say in the US, organizations are the main place, or if there is any main place where people of different social classes meet on a continuous basis. You know, if you are Meta or any kind of tech company, let's say, and you've got your programmers in place X, and then you've got your content moderators in the global south, and you've got other things subcontracted out, your device manufacturers and so on and so forth. There's no real meeting of classes happening in a way that can shape social relations significantly beyond kind of contractual interchange between workers. And so I do think it is to some extent a whole other ballgame in today's world.
Absolutely. You talked about Jerry Davis and sort of the changing nature of work that his research focused on. Another focus of his is about organizational inequality, right? And he has that argument that organizations have actually helped lessen inequality in societies. And then when you even take a step back and talk about going back to what we had started discussing earlier, the role of organizations in reshaping the environment, right? To the extent that organizations have adopted certain initiatives, for example, DEI, right? And then sort of embrace this and sort of amplify the calls for it from society, you can see sort of these changes play out. The example that comes to mind is Disney in response to Governor DeSantis's stance on LGBTQ issues, right? And this idea that Disney is a very old organization, right? We can say that they're quite innovative in certain ways. They definitely don't suffer from the liability of newness. But because they're taking a stance on a social issue, they're having an economic impact on society way larger than their typical products, right? So to the extent that organizations are in and of themselves an ecosystem that can affect sort of systems of inequality, that can take stances on systems of inequality, that's something that is above and beyond Sinchcombe's initial propositions in his essay.
So let me read the definition that Sinchcombe gives of organization. And he says that by organization, he means a set of stable social relations deliberately created with the explicit intention of continuously accomplishing some specific goals and purposes. And at first, Rahim was inviting us to think in terms of how continuous it really is nowadays, or how more uncontinuous, non-continuous forms have emerged, right? So then the definition is to be broadened. But also what you're saying, Shelby, is that the specific goals and purposes also need to be expanded in our definition to some extent, or at least we have to grapple with the fact that the interaction between organization and society is a little bit more imbricated with each other, because organizations may have multiple purposes and goals. They may be conflicting. They be expected to take a stance, except that it's not necessarily what they're trying to build, construct, right, and deliver. So it's not about Disney, what kind of just the movies it's and experience in the parks that it provides, but also where is its role or stance in a number of social issues, right? So I think there are also different way in which the connection and interdependence between social structure and organization is being reshaped and is being at least more salient to us nowadays.
Yeah, I kind of like, we're using the term ecology because like in Disney, there's like Disney, and then there's different subordinate parts of Disney that even though they share a common moniker, they are almost completely different organizations, I mean, in manifestation. And I also look at the U.S. military as another example of this, where you have significantly different parts of the organization that interact and influence society in different ways. Like with Disney, the parks are serving one purpose and they influence society in a certain way by changing the way that we think about vacations versus consumption in the movies versus consumption in toy stores and all of that sort of thing. I do think sometimes that it's easy for us to get hooked up on the moniker and think of the organization as a holistic unitary entity, when in reality, there's that ecosystem is really important to think about the different ways and the different avenues and how that shifts over time of how we interact with these large entities. Because I think sometimes the large entities go through phases where they try to enforce or promote the uniform unitary identity. And at other times they distribute it depending on what they think serve either the whims of the CEO or what they think the public is hungry to consume.
So you're expanding a third way. We are saying that organizations are not just, continuous. They don't necessarily have one clear specific purpose, but maybe many, but also they are not a monolith, right? So they are themselves made of different parts and fragmented and might be not consonant with each other and so on.
It does bring to mind this idea of organizations, again, sort of reflecting pressures or responding to pressures from the environment, and sort of going back to the DEI example, right? Now we had our traditional C-suite, we still have, you know, the CEO, the CFO, CMO, et cetera, right? But now we have sort of the chief people officer, right? Or the chief diversity officer. And then the idea of like, we're creating entire departments that are centered around that. We see this in universities, we see this in sort of the large firms. And this idea then that through institutionalizing certain roles and highlighting these certain roles, they are able to emphasize sort of the legitimacy of certain societal claims that way. But at the same time, again, as an institutionalist, right, the idea of ceremonial compliance, the idea of symbolic kind of management in this way, to what extent do organizations reflect a true sort of calling within society? To what extent do they actually genuinely believe in that, or to what extent are they just sort of putting something in place temporarily, right, as a way to shield themselves from potential scrutiny, and then over time, once sort of the attention dies down, they can potentially do away with it. The stickiness of some of these changes and the genuineness of organizations in terms of changing this can be called into question. And this harkens back to Tom's point too, right, of like at the beginning of our podcast, we talked about how inertia plays a huge role in the difficulty of implementing organizational change. We're seeing a lot of changes now. To what extent are these changes actually real, right, and actually permanent?
So I'm sure someone already used this term, but I listened to you, was thinking maybe there is a liability of new roles. The work of José Luis Álvarez and Sivas Vejanova on their very interesting current and recent published book, The Changing C-Suite, talks a little bit about that, right? The different roles that you're referring, the different expansion of the C-suite and how new concerns are brought up. But I think one of the things that is interesting in the book, I'm still reading it, so maybe, you know, I'm getting it wrong, I haven't finished yet, is that there is almost like a existential anxiety or precarity or even liability, we may say, or unclarity about what exactly such roles are supposed to do, how they relate to each other, how much leeway and power they're able to accumulate and bring into, right? So it's a little bit what you're saying, but not just in terms of the legitimacy or the decoupling, right? But also in terms of this liability, right? Because it's something that is not an entire new organizational form, but a configuration or role that emerging within this, to use Tom's term, ecosystems of different components that organizations are made of.
I also think about that in terms of, in a way, I think organizations they're flailing about a bit, which is probably too strong a term, but they're really struggling to figure out how to respond / protect themselves from things in which really, when you get down to it, somewhat outside of what their ordinary mission area is. And, there's really three ways of defending yourself, right? You can either confront an opponent, you can deflect the opponent's points, or you can accommodate. And as in, you go ahead and change as sort of like a, yes, we agree, but we're going to fix something our way. I interpret a lot of this as part of what is going to help us avoid getting too distracted from what it is that we really feel we should be doing. And I say that a lot in the way in which some of these initiatives are presented. And so then what happens is that you end up with a proliferation and you're wondering, okay, how is this organization really posturing itself to better engage with society as opposed to just throwing a bone to the issue and trying to blunt the opposition, I guess, would be a way to put it. It's hard because the more complex things get, then the more complicated the organization's leadership, ecosystem, the organization's leadership is, and the harder it is to be leading the organization as you see it fit. You get tugged and pulled. And that, I think, is part of the problem.
Yeah, and adding to that complexity point, Tom, if we layer on all the subsequent research that we've had on the kind of more cognitive views of organizations, then there's the whole element of what are you attending to or not attending to? And this is a bit of, I guess, Willy Ocasio and attention work. And there's the Wykean idea of how are you interpreting the social structure around you, and the way you interpret your social structure depends a bit on your own, perhaps when you were founded and your cohort of founding and the imprinting of ideologies. And so then that means more complexity, means more interpretations, means more things to choose between in terms of where your attention is. And that complicates the whole picture in terms of whether the same set of, let's say, social structures would affect industry in the same way or not.
So in this part, we have been talking about on how the environment has changed, right? How organizations have been able to influence the environment, how we may need to expand the definition for organization. But since the environment has changed and organizational influence more the environment, I was thinking maybe we also have to expand our understanding of the environment of society. Because one of the ways in which there can be a bearing from society or social structure to the organization is also in terms of stigma. And I think that's kind of, in a way, you are hinting at, Tom, right? That the environment is not just a resource or foundation, but also can be a stigmatizing or sticky, complicating factor, either because public opinion changes about a particular employment arrangement or organizational way of accomplishing a goal, or also because there are new demands, and depending on how you respond and how is the perception of that, that can also be our source of, for the lack of a better word, liability as well.
I agree. And I'm glad you brought up stigma, because it comes to mind some of the conversations that we're having nowadays in which the organization cannot possibly give a good answer. When you have such sharply divergent views on what constitutes norms in society or whatever, that are mutually exclusive, and you as an organization, especially those that you really wish to be devoting your goods and services to everybody as wide a market as possible, and you have no choice but to navigate what is an impossible tension, then how does an organization cope with that? It almost requires them to come up with a chief officer of some kind devoted to a particular tension point solely to navigate the organization through that tension to protect itself from criticism from both sides. And it's not just the environment you're all kind of alluding to, too, is that the environment is among the members. I mean, the members are members of society who are partaking in these discussions. And especially in a social media environment, organizations can be very, very nervous about how individual members of the organization are participating in these conversations in a way that puts the organization itself at risk. And that's one that scares the heck out of a lot of organizational leaders. Never mind the fact that some of the CEOs have gotten themselves into some serious trouble lately because they've made some dumb comments on social media, you know. That sort of thing too. But yeah, it is difficult because on the one hand, you know, when we're talking about temporary organizations or, you know, entrepreneurs and whatever, you want to be able to get into the market and you want to be able to establish yourself and whatever. But it also almost seems impossible to be able to set up new organizations that don't have some of this internal security presence or internal, I don't know what to call it, but like you got to have this ability to navigate the pitfalls of society type tensions built into the organization when you construct it. Otherwise, you may run yourself unwittingly at risk.
No, absolutely. One of the things that I find fascinating in my work in terms of corporate governance and specifically board of directors is this idea of like, who are you bringing in to address the kind of threats that you're seeing out there, right? There are people who want individuals who are well-versed in social media and sort of the defenses, right, that you need to combat sort of some of these social media backlashes that you see often. You see sort of cybersecurity risks as well, people needing that kind of expertise so that you can, again, protect yourself from people attacking you through your security systems. One of the things that highlights is sort of a point that you brought up, Tom, right? Of this idea that organizations no longer just have this for-profit focus, right? The shareholder profits above all. There's a sense that they have to respond to other issues as well because these issues can affect their bottom line, but also because they're expected to, right? So I know that at UIUC, they have the ISOI initiative, and one of the key sort of interests there, in addition to sort of organizational attention, is this idea of organizational values, right? Organizations now need to have values, things that they uphold, things that allow for their employees, different parts of their organization to come together and for them to sort of believe in. And this is a very Selznickian view, so it's not it's not groundbreaking in that way. But the idea of values has become so much more important in recent times, because what an organization does, their stances on some of these social issues may be informed by their values, in which case it becomes a lot more meaningful, a lot more real. But if it's sort of it's something that is going against their values, then maybe it's just a defensive mechanism, something that they sort of scaffold in place to be able to shield themselves from some of the scrutiny that's out there.
Where do we go?
Have we satisfactorily discussed the superior inferior piece towards the end, or his concluding comments?
I think we touched upon it a bit when it comes to sort of the work from home element, and then sort of the emphasis on unions, right? Starbucks and the whole union.
Mm-hmm. One thing I don't know about, maybe someone knows about, is what does this all of this means for entrepreneurship, right? Because some of this liability of unions, sometimes I think it's debated there, but I have no idea of the conversation there. So I was like, maybe someone has an idea.
Yeah, I don't know if I know about the conversation, but it is interesting to think about, like, specifically social media influencers. Because originally, what was an influencer? It was a single person with a camera or a smartphone. But nowadays, when we think about what's involved in being an influencer, many of them have crews. They've essentially developed organizations, and they're using Patreon. They're using different means in order to monetize what they do. And it's very interesting to see how that has been developing, especially after COVID, because I think at the same time, there's also a question as to how much influence does an influencer actually have? How much is an influencer really changing society? There was a recent bit from one influencer who was trying to establish a new clothing line, who had millions of followers, and come to find out that absolutely nobody signed up to actually buy anything. So what does the meaning of having millions of followers have, as we're seeing how these new types of, I guess, organizations form and whatever? Because obviously there are some influencers who are doing far better than that particular case. But I just want to say that, by the way, what is the most... If you ask high school students nowadays, what is the number one thing that they want to be when they grow up? Right now, the number one thing is social media influencer.
So, okay, maybe because I had a birthday recently, now I'm feeling old because I never imagined that would be like such a popular career choice. But in more conceptual terms, I think that what we are now talking is about expanding the arrow between organizations and society. I'm forcing a little bit this, but what I'm saying is that I see almost two elements that a lot of course attacks by Stinchcom is about the creation of new organizations, and in particular, new organizational types, new ways in which organizations are structured. But we can also think about entrepreneurs that may or may not create an organization. And what you're saying is that there is this way in which they are using some scattered modular blocks that are available digitally nowadays, in which they do not fully create an organization, right? You know, so it's not the case of an influencer creating the new department store, but it's not just putting a video out there, right? It's something in the interstices in which one can maybe hire help to, you know, build a website and hire people to, you know, create logos for t-shirts and hire people to manufacture the t-shirt and then hire another person for do the marketing, right? And can construct such operations. And I think that's what, of course, Jerry Davis has talked, you know, as well, in terms of this entrepreneurial spirit that's not only being channeled into the creation of full new own organization, but uses different organizational elements that are available in the environment. So, you know, this environment and organization, you know, intermesh in a different way to be able to sell services, sell products, offer, I don't know, any kind of marketable services and products out there.
Yeah, I think what we're kind of arriving at as we slowly step away from Stinchcomb's definitions of society and of organization, and we start including more and more of at least the phenomena that we see around us in today's world, is that perhaps what is most useful about Stinchcomb? You know, if I use the most abstract terms of just work and non-work domains of social activity, is the idea of the work and non-work domains influencing each other irreciprocally? And perhaps this also has to do with kind of when he was writing, because at that time, the dominant thought may have been that your work domain is based on your work objectives, how you organize the work, and the non-work domain is based on institutions like religion or national ideology. And then the idea that the way the work domain is organized and the way the non-work domain is organized are reciprocally influencing one another holds regardless of how you define organizations or structures.
I think just like from a meta point of view, right? A lot of this is just, what is an organization? And I think that that's such an age-old question that still needs to be answered, right? And it hasn't been, in some ways, cannot be fully answered given how things are changing, right? Are influencers organizations? By some definitions, yes. By some definitions, no. Some like temporary organizations, do they count as organizations in the traditional sense, right? Maybe yes, maybe no. And I think that one of the challenges in applying classical theories such as Stinchcomb to modern day phenomenon is that these phenomena are so much in flux and are subject to so many different kinds of points of view that it's hard to nail it down and be able to categorize them in that way. But to the extent that we can make sense of these new organizations through a more traditional lens from some of these theories, maybe that's enough, right? Maybe that's progress. It's not a perfect explanation, but it's some progress towards a better understanding of these things.
Well, Jerry Davis, if you're listening, please dial in right now and help us solve this problem once and for all.
We thank our special guest, Shelby Guy, for joining us in this episode.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.